WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In David Lodge's new novel, a businessman confesses to a university professor that he loves her. The professor responds, "There's no such thing as love. It's a rhetorical device. It's a bourgeois fallacy. When I was younger, I allowed myself to be constructed by the discourse of romantic love." David Lodge's novels satirize the language of literary criticism and life in academia. He has an insider's knowledge of both. For 17 years, he taught English at the University of Birmingham in England, and is the author of several books of literary criticism in addition to 8 novels. His latest novel, Nice Work, is about an affair between a woman professor who knows nothing outside academic literary theory and a man in the industrial world who knows nothing about culture. I asked David Lodge why he brought these two characters together.
Well, I've written several novels before about the academic world, and some people, I think, seem to imply I could only write about the academic world, so there was a sense in which I wanted to prove I could write about something else. I was also living in the West Midlands, in Birmingham, in England, through a decade of considerable social and economic upheaval, I mean, broadly, the Thatcher years. And this had brought considerable disruption, both and a recession, indeed, to local engineering industry, and also had imposed severe cuts on the universities of England, including the one I was working in at the time. And I really wanted to explore these subjects in a novel. Originally, I thought of it really being centred on the man and about his a kind of midlife crisis of a sort of industrial executive coinciding with some relationship with a woman from an intellectual background that he hadn't had any previous encounter with. And it was through doing the research to find out what kind of work such a man would do that I thought of the shadow scheme, and that was a way of bringing these two characters together.
Yeah, the shadow scheme is that it's the government designates the year industry year. So, you know, people from academia are being teamed up with people in the business world. So she, your woman character, is teamed up with this man who works in the corporate world. Was there any such scheme in real life, or did you just come up with this for a device for the novel?
Well, I actually invented it as a kind of cover for doing the research. I mean, I followed a friend around who is a managing director of an engineering company, and to explain my presence, we said that I was shadowing him as part of an industry year plan. It was industry year in 1986, so that made the story plausible. And shadow schemes are quite common, but there wasn't actually one between Birmingham University and local industry.
I would like you to read the paragraph in which you introduce Robin, and she's the character who teaches literature at the university. Her area of specialization is the industrial novel, and this is the paragraph in which she's introduced.
Right. The previous chapter ends with Vic Wilcox, the industrialist, at his desk in his factory in the morning, on a Monday morning in winter. And there, for the time being, let us leave Vic Wilcox while we travel back an hour or two in time, a few miles in space, to meet a very different character. A character who, rather awkwardly for me, doesn't herself believe in the concept of character. That is to say, a favourite phrase of her own, Robin Penrose, temporary lecturer in English literature at the University of Rummidge, holds that character is a bourgeois myth, an illusion created to reinforce the ideology of capitalism. As evidence for this assertion, she will point to the fact that the rise of the novel, the literary genre of character par excellence, in the 18th century, coincided with the rise of capitalism, that the triumph of the novel over all other literary genre in the 19th century coincided with the triumph of capitalism, and that the modernist and postmodernist deconstruction of the classic novel in the 20th century has coincided with the terminal crisis of capitalism.
Robin later goes on to say that the novelist is the capitalist of the imagination. Do you have colleagues at the university who speak like this about capitalism in the novel?
I speak like it myself with my other hat on,
yes.
Or have been known to, yes.
I was wondering if you think that that the language of structuralism has, in a way, really distanced academics from the rest of the world because nobody else understands it.
That's true. And it is ironic and perhaps tragic because, the subject matter of literary criticism is not just a professional subject matter. It's also something common to everybody. And there is a sort of paradox that the discourse about literature in the academy should be so impenetrable and so alien for people who enjoy books and enjoy literature, but can't understand the critical commentary upon it. That, I think, is regrettable.
You said that it's less common for British professors to also write popular novels than it is for American professors?
I think it's probably rare for either country for professors to write popular novels. We don't have many creative writing programs in universities in Britain, so there are fewer writers on campus, and there are one or two like myself who profess English literature and write books of criticism and, as it were, write novels in their spare time.
How did you end up playing both roles, academic and novelist?
Well, it started out, I always wanted to be a writer, and the academic profession seemed a good one to combine with that. I never thought as a young man I could support myself as a freelance writer. So I went into the academic world for that reason. But I got interested in academic criticism and the activity of teaching in its own right. And for most of my adult life, I pursued these two careers in tandem and deliberately almost wrote a novel and a critical book alternately. And it was often rather refreshing to turn from one kind of work to another. But a few years ago, I began to get a little weary of the academic world and took the opportunity to leave it.
So you don't teach anymore?
Very little. I mean, I have an honorary title, so I'm still connected with the university and I give occasional lectures. I could teach more if I wanted to, but at the moment I don't want to.
Do you still like visiting universities a lot so you get a sense of what the drift is there?
Yes, I do, and I still get plenty of opportunities to do that. But I think that I doubt whether I'm going to write any more criticism which will be a contribution to the academic study of the subject, because once you leave the institution and its incentives and drives and compulsions, you no longer really feel like making the effort to keep up with the professional journals and so on the subject.
If you don't mind my asking, I know that you have a son who was born with Down syndrome, and I guess I'd be interested in hearing what it's been like for you as someone who lives very much in an intellectual world to have a son who's learning disabled.
Well, it was quite a shock at first. I mean, when he was born, it was not something my wife or I had ever thought about or considered to be something that might happen to us. And I won't disguise the fact that it was very painful and sad experience in many ways. But Christopher, the boy in question, fortunately he's physically very healthy, and really he's brought a great deal of happiness to us. Really, the way he's grown up and the amount of things he's been able to achieve, I suppose you could say it was a salutary sort of experience, in as much as being an intellectual, one does tend to value intelligence above all things. And Down's people are not terribly bright, but they are very lovable and loving. And they're also, on the whole, rather happy, at least Christopher is. I mean, he doesn't suffer from the kind of anxieties that most adults do. So it hasn't been, by any means, all a negative experience. It's been, in many ways, a very positive experience. But there is a kind of poignancy in the fact that one can see in him occasionally glimpses of a very brilliant person that he would have been, because for a Down's boy, his remarkable linguistic ability, really, and he takes a great interest in my work. It's slightly sad to think that it was just this extra stray chromosome that prevented him from being a writer himself.
You say he takes an interest in your work and your novels?
Yeah, he does, yeah. I mean, he's much more enthusiastic about my writing than my two normal children. I think would prefer if I didn't write novels at all.
Do your other children read your books?
Yeah, inevitably, but they read them rather late in life, by mutual choice, I think.
Why didn't you want them to read them earlier?
Well, it's like the kind of taboos on discussions of sexuality in a family, I think. I mean, there's an element of private revelation or possible private revelation in any work of fiction. And there's also a sense in which you are or can be seen to be reflecting upon your own immediate relationships. And the sort of the delicate balance between fiction and reality is something I try and preserve, and I try not to write anything which would offend people. But I can see why my children might feel rather sensitive about reading what I write, and I feel the same. I mean, I never felt any desire to press the books upon them or discuss them in great detail with them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Writer David Lodge. His latest novel, Nice Work, has just been published in paperback by Penguin Books.